everyone, and welcome back to the Back in the Day podcast, Metro Archives' lively series all about Nashville's culture and history. Today's episode is a follow-up to our last podcast with L.A. Wilson, where we talked about Harvey's and the Centennial Park nativity scene. This time, we're fortunate enough to speak with a descendant of Fred Harvey. I got my wish from my last podcast whenever I ended it that way. Fred Harvey was the man behind the store and its beloved annual Christmas display. So today, we're joined by his grandson, Fred Harvey III. Thank you for being here with us, Fred.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This is awesome. I want to hear from, like, firsthand personal experience. So just to get us started, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, recently retired. Maybe not that recently, but I've been retired for a little bit.
Retired from?
Construction.
You do?
I was okay. In residential home building.
Okay. Cool.
Most of the latter part of my career.
Oh, okay.
But growing up in mm-hmm. the store, I just recently got a Social Security statement that, you know, mm-hmm. records your my first Social Security payment. Was in 67, so I was like 10 years old.
Oh, wow.
And actually on the payroll for as a stock boy or mm-hmm. something like that. I did quite a bit of mm-hmm. things kind of growing up, going in on Saturdays, working during the summer and stuff. And later, after a short stint in college, I decided that school never was a great student, but didn't like it.
And you said you went to school where we're at now, Nashville State Community College?
Yeah, I did that after we sold the store in 88.
Okay.
Probably 76, 77. Mm-hmm. I came to work as an assistant buyer in Better Dresses. And then later became a buyer and did that. That was Budget Sportswear. And they had moved it to the main floor. So it was a pretty busy department.
Okay. What was your first job with Harvey's?
Well, I don't know if it was my first.
Or at least what you
but
remember.
But one of my least favorite was going up to the receiving room on 6th floor. And, you know, when we check merchandise in, ready to wear and such, clothing, you know, we'd put it on hangers. And then when it was sold, the hangers were put in bins. And then the bins would get dumped into buggies. And then you had this huge pile of hangers had to be sorted.
Ooh.
And they'd stick together. And, you know, they had those clips. And they had, you know, little bars on there for mm-hmm. pants. It was maddening.
Does sound pretty frustrating, to be honest.
And I would sort hangers all day.
Oh, my.
I think one day I just said, no.
I will not do this
anymore.
I was
still really young. But I did like, sometimes I would do trash runs, and we had a couple of furnaces, you know, and they'd have chutes that spiraled all the way down. I never was brave to go down there, but my brother did that.
Oh, did he?
So let's see. The most fun I had was working with a maintenance man. His name was Charles Greenlee, and he was up from Florida. And very talented, very gentle, very wonderful man. And I just tagged along with him as much as I could.
Nice.
And we walked out on the roofs and put these big chemical blocks in the the water towers for the air conditioning
mm-hmm.
to keep the algae down. We checked all kinds of maintenance equipment, you know, mm-hmm. up in the very tip top of the building where all the elevators were, all the big, you know, electric motors that operated the elevators, and there was just a million secret little hiding places where electrical panels were.
Ooh.
Might change a breaker or, something was always, you know, something. We were checking on the escalators, would get shut down, and we'd open up those things in the floor and climb down in. You know,
ooh.
It was just,
oh, wow.
That was kind of, it was really, really enjoyed that.
Well-rounded experience there.
And so would make my rounds. I worked in the warehouse over on Oldham Street.
Oh, I didn't know there was a warehouse. Okay.
Yep.
Makes sense.
We had, I think it was 7 bays, 10,000 square feet each. And that's where we received a lot of the furniture and that kind of stuff. And we would have big sales there. I think it was monthly on a Saturday, free hot dogs and Cokes.
Ooh.
And everybody'd come. This was later stuff that my father initiated.
Mm, okay.
So.
And what year did he take over? He took over when your grandfather passed, correct?
In 1960.
Okay.
He was 28.
Wow.
He was, I think, the youngest independent retailer in the country, I believe.
Mm, took on an empire there.
He did.
Yeah. Wow. Very cool. So what other jobs? And I think in L.A. Wilson's book, she lists, I forget the different jobs you have while working there. Do you have, you already listed, I guess, your favorite. Do you have your, or you listed your least favorite. What was your favorite?
Well, some of the most fond times, a lot, you know, I would go in with my dad on, sometimes on Sundays, because he traveled quite a bit. You know, market was, you know, there was somebody's market about every 3 months. So that put him in New York for better part of a week. Mm. And in that time, his desk would get piled up, and he would come in on Friday night, and Saturday he'd go to work. Sunday, or if he was just getting back Saturday, Sunday we would go in, the store was closed, and he would clean off his desk. Well, I was running around everywhere. We'd get bicycles out. And so I had fun. My brother and I would ride bicycles through the china and glass department.
Oh.
Because the toy department and sporting goods was on the fourth floor, as was china, glass, silver, and housewares, I think.
Wow.
And and the tires were usually about flat. It's a miracle we didn't crash through something. But that was the thing, you know.
The china, yeah.
So,
wow.
I don't know. We had carpets, and they had, you know, those big rolls of carpet in the back. So somebody would look at swaths, and then they would, you know, decide, well, these big rolls, we'd climb on those things and unroll them. I'm sure those people were really unhappy with us when they came in Monday, but...
That's quite the childhood there, growing up in a department store.
Yeah, we would get in the store windows, you know, along 6th Avenue and down Church, cross 5th Avenue even. We didn't go into 5th Avenue that much. There was a bridge, you know, that connected the two buildings, St. Cloud Corner and the Liebeck Building.
Okay.
But on the 6th Avenue side was, I think it was 6 or 7 buildings that were, the Hitchcock Building was on the corner, and then Rich Schwartz, and I mean, there was, I think it was 7, including one building, the Harvey Building, which was a three-sided building that opened up to the backside of the Liebeck Building. This was closest to Hermitage Hotel, up 6th Avenue away from Church.
Gotcha.
But anyway, we'd get in the windows and get still and let somebody walk by and then move around, you know, try and scare people or whatever.
I love that. That's what I would do probably as well if I had that opportunity.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the movie Mannequin from the 1980s just a little bit. We were talking earlier, I was explaining to Chris about where Harvey's was located with the multiple buildings, and it spanned, like you said, from 5th to 6th Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
When did they merge? Because it started with the Liebeck's Building as the original.
Mm-hmm.
When did it expand to all the way to the 5th? Do you know?
No. Mm. I suspect after the big lawsuit.
She does mention that in her book. Okay.
And the reason being, if we were already operating in the rest of the store, it wouldn't have been so critical for us to get that lease back.
Mm-hmm.
But to review what many people probably didn't know was, after my grandfather got up and going real well and had taken over the Liebeck company and turned it into Harvey's and continued with a lot of the people had been working. I knew people that had started with Liebeck's and were still with Harvey's.
Oh, I like that. That's good.
Mm-hmm. When I was a kid and into the 70s,
mm-hmm.
probably
wow.
into the 80s maybe even, I don't know. But
wow.
at any rate, the Kane Sloan folks, through whoever was managing the trust for the beneficiaries of that building, that owned that building, it was in a trust, and the trust was landlord. And so the Kane Sloan got our lease, basically.
Hmm.
And what would have happened is it would have, I mean, we didn't have a place. We'd been run right out of the building.
Right, yeah.
And so the lower courts ruled in our favor, said that it was unfair to force us to move without at least having a chance to mm-hmm. match whatever rent. And then we won in the lower court and we lost in the appellate court. So then it went to the state Supreme Court. And that was the big, you know, mm-hmm. hoopla.
Yeah.
And back then, maybe even now, I don't know, but a typical lease arrangement might, you know, be so much per square foot. And then at some point, there was a point where you made percentage rent. In other words, if the volume of the business got up to whatever, 2 million, just to throw out a figure, and we had percentage rent of what, 5% or whatever,
mm-hmm.
then we could calculate our overhead. And it also meant that the more we did, the more rent they got. And so it kind of turned into who would make the most money for the trust and for the benefactors of the trust.
I see.
And so if you know anything about my grandfather, you know, there was a little bit of ego involved. And he was going to take every opportunity to make that a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to, at any point he could, represent how great Harvey's was, and maybe not go down on Kane Sloan's, but how much better we were than Kane
Sloan's.
He was Sloan's.
A true businessman.
So I met him, I knew him, but I was 3 years old. So my memories of him are pretty limited, but
sure.
I felt like I kind of got to know him by talking to the older employees that worked for him and had stayed on, you know, until we sold the store even.
Mm-hmm.
But more or less a showman, sort of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey of retail, the retail world.
Yeah.
And I had the pleasure one time. And at the very end of Belmead Boulevard is Percy Warner Golf Course, and it's a little public course. It's 9 holes. It's not a big challenge, but it's convenient, and it was nice. And you could just walk right up, and the starter would put you with different people. And I had the pleasure of going around with John Siegenthaler, Sr.
Wow.
And he was a Cub reporter, his words, at the time of the lawsuit. And here he was for the Banner, the Tennessean, I'm not sure. But
either.
Yeah, he was at the courthouse. He had to cover the courthouse. He had to cover this lawsuit. And mm-hmm. he was just so delighted to meet me and tell me stories about my grandfather. He said, you know, they'd Aww. Sit him down on the hot seat, you know, and question him and say, well, isn't it true, Mr. Harvey, that you said you were going to do whatever, $10 million this year? And, yep, that's correct. And he said, but you didn't do that, did you, Mr. Harvey? No, I didn't. We only came in at 8.3, but we're doing $10 million next year, you know. And so there was there were stories that Lily told me that she had found in the actual court documents That she's got in her book. That
she does, yeah.
She found so much stuff. That's
she did great.
Incredible, yeah. Mm-hmm. what she uncovered. Because most of what I knew was kind of, you know, family lore or something.
Sure.
You know, it was hearsay. I mean, I had my own experiences there for sure. But
You
start talking about my grandfather, it was, well, just like what John Siegenthaler told me. Or it'd be another clerk at the store. I remember when your dad and such and such, and or I remember your grandfather did this, and you know he was so nice. I've heard a million stories and don't know
mm-hmm.
how true they are, because people would embellish, I guess, and they were proud that they'd heard this and it changed a little bit. An example would be we always had construction going on. So one of our other slogans was Harvey's, the store that will never know completion.
I guess I haven't heard that one. Okay.
Yeah, along with no sale is final until the customer is completely satisfied. Or,
wow.
You know, Harvey's has it. Of course, everybody knows that one. But so we were constantly updating different departments. You know, cosmetics would get moved or reconfigured, or we'd add another line of cosmetics, you know. And always trying to get, cosmetics was a very competitive department, main floor.
That.
And, you know, if you could get Estee Lauder or Clinique or, you know, some of those
mm-hmm.
really, and they were exclusive, you know, and we were kind of the small guy. So comparatively, Kane Sloan had been taken over by Allied. So they were a national chain. Castronaut been taken over by Mercantile. That was a national chain. And we were still local, independent, kind of Middle Tennessee, ultimately Middle Tennessee, Southern Kentucky. So we had a carpenter named Earl and a painter. They had a full-time job, and they were a part of display. And, I mean, master craftsmen, painting and carpentry. And we had, you know, other construction people at different times. I actually worked there when I was in college for a while.
Okay.
I was always kind of on the mechanical, you know, that was mm-hmm. sort of where I was. But anyway, there was a story that Mr. Earl, I think, was the painter, actually, and he was on the ladder. I don't know. whoever the painter was,
mm-hmm.
my grandfather told him to, like, spill some paint on this lady.
Oh.
And he did, supposedly. I asked my father about the story, and he just naysayed it. But I think it's a great story.
Yeah.
So my grandfather went running up and said, "Oh, my God, I can't believe this. Come with me. Well, let me take you upstairs to the coat department. You pick out any coat you want, and I'm gonna buy it for you to replace, you know,
mm-hmm.
the one we got paint on or whatever, that kind of thing." And
wow.
Stories like real slow day, Saturday morning, you know, we'd have more business in here with a cage full of monkeys.
and then the next season we've got
four rhesus monkeys in a cage on the second floor where the carousel and all the,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you had a place. He had a, you know, we had rides. We had a big elephant head, huge slide.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost scary to think little kids went up this thing and
sure.
went down and had a stagecoach, and you could we'd climb on the top of the stagecoach, and you know, somebody'd stick a quarter in there, and you could pretend like you're, it was probably a dime, maybe even a nickel back then, I mm-hmm. guess. Little race cars.
Mm.
And then they called it the monkey bar, but it was kind of a soda fountain. But you could get hamburgers and hot dogs and stuff like that. And so it was a place where you could come, sit down, have lunch. Your kids could play. We had a big merry-go-round there. Max Lowenstein was a Holocaust survivor
mm-hmm.
and had quite a story. And I don't know, my grandfather met him or something. I think he sponsored him to come over here. I'm not certain about all that. But, you know, of course, the war broke out. World War II broke out right when he was trying to open the place.
That's right. It was 42
yeah.
he opened? Yeah. Okay.
So,
wow.
You know, that was a bold move. I'm sure it was
yeah.
a, you know, major disappointment. for him because you couldn't get anything.
Right.
Everything was for the war effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a bold thing to do to open up that store when he did. I can only imagine the worst time would be 1929, but 42.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Which also led to our logo, the carousel horse.
Right, and the horses came from the old Glendale Park, correct?
Glendale Park and Zoo, which I think there's a Glendale Park, was elementary school, I think it's still there, over by the Governor's Mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And after we sold, I guess they'd done a history on their actual location, and we donated one of the original horses.
Oh, nice.
That came off the carousel, but my grandfather came to town and decided to do business here and got financing with Commerce Union.
Mm-hmm.
And Glendale Park was an entity of itself that was failing, and NES decided, well, we'll just run some trolley car tracks out there, and that should bolster it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that didn't work out too good. It ended up in receivership, and I guess they mentioned it to my grandfather about the carousel, and you couldn't get anything for decorations. Everything was for the war effort.
Yeah.
So he thought, well, sure, he bought that out of receivership and scattered the horses around, and then it became, you know, as more became available, and we'd always open up a branch store and have one.
And have one there, okay.
Do
you still have the one that you were given? I read in her book that you received them.
Yeah. Well, when we sold the store, part of the arrangement with the buyers, with Peebles, was that we kept certain, you know, things.
Mm-hmm.
And carousel horses was part of that.
Okay.
So a guy that actually ran the warehouse, his name was Leon Dobbs, and after... Later, when we closed the warehouse, we got out of furniture, we got out of carpeting, we got out of, you know, the over the years, the specialty stores, kind of like Toys R Us or whatever.
I see, yeah.
Put us out. I'll bring up a friend of mine and maybe something that you'd want to pursue, but Phillips Toy Mart was like three or four generations.
Oh, okay. And
they survived all that. Matter of fact, Cynthia Phillips is a friend of mine, and I always compliment her about the way they were able to
persevere.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would love to have them on. Yeah. Hopefully.
Anyway, so Leon was a mechanical guy, and we switched to a different cash register system, and. At this point in my career, I was in operations, so we rewired all the stores for, you know, automated information gathering.
Okay.
We were old school for many, many years where you actually had to take the tickets that were torn off and log what was sold and which store it was sold, and it was maddening. It was one of the reasons I really had a hard time with that as an assistant buyer. That was my second least favorite thing to do.
Gotcha.
Log tickets. But
me too.
So anyway, after the deal was done, we went around to all the stores and gathered up all the horses and collected them. And my father got the three of us, my brother and my sister and I, together and let us pick out a horse. And he wasn't even going to take one. I said, heck, you know, you need to. And... he took the one that we had up in Madison, which was a really, really elaborate horse. There's a lot to those horses. You don't think about it, but the outside of the outside horse was more elaborate than the inside of the horse. And there was basically three style horses, a stander, which was one leg up and three down, a prancer, which was the front two legs up, and then a jumper, which is all four legs up.
I did not know that there was that much detail to them.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So those, you know, people got to choose, you know, whether they were kind of a walking horse, I guess, or a cantering horse or a jumping horse, maybe.
Okay.
When they were on the carousel.
All right, then.
And the standards became the most appreciated. Mm-hmm. I guess they're the easiest to display in your home if, you know, you were into doing that. But so we had a very nice one at the Madison store. That was our second branch. The first branch was Clarksville.
Okay.
And I think we opened that mid-60s.
That's when your father took over the business, is that correct, when branches started
happening?
Well,
it was shortly after, yeah. And okay. It was apparent that my grandfather was a proponent for downtown because, I mean, that was all downtown sure. was always the deal. And during the lawsuit is when Green Hills, you know, started to come about. And we kind of missed an opportunity probably to be in Green Hills. Of course, Castronaut and Kane Sloan were. And they probably did everything they could to keep us out, I suspect. But my grandfather probably wasn't that interested, you know. He was old school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he died in 1960. I think he was 60.
Oh, wow.
He may have been, yeah, I think he was 60. I think he was 60 years old, although he died, born in 1899, I believe. And I'm not certain about that.
Seems to track with what her book has, but I can't remember
yeah.
for sure.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, when my father took over, it became apparent that, you know, the business was getting pulled to the suburbs. And the first choice, we went with Montgomery Ward in a little strip center. And wartime hit us again.
Hmm.
The 101st ships out to Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
And all the families, I'm sure, scattered into their, you know, families of origin type thing.
Yeah.
You know, moved in with the in-laws or, you know. And I'll just say, people don't consider the families of soldiers. And mm-hmm. we've gotten, you know, pretty nationalistic. And I mean, the Vietnam soldiers were, I never understood it, but, you know, they were,
different.
They were really, really cast down later in the war during all the, you know, rioting and everything. And somehow or another, you know, they became the victims of the, mm-hmm. you know, the peace marchers in a lot of cases. And so finally we're happy that, you know, it's kind of late, but hopefully,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah. I grew up watching that war. I was too young to go.
My dad just missed the draft, I think. I think when he graduated, technically he would have, but then that's, I think, whenever the war ended. So, but yeah, they talk about it.
When I was early in high school, you know, the seniors would get out the newspaper and look at the, you know, because everybody born on January 3rd might be, you know, whatever, the 15th,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And it was pretty scary if you had a low number.
Yeah, definitely. I think my dad tells the story that when he graduated, my grandmother gave him a watch for his graduation gift and said that it was guaranteed to work in Vietnam. I'm like, thanks, Grandma.
My father gave me one, too. It didn't say that. But, that must have been a thing.
Yeah. Thanks, Mom.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I read a book last year called The Women that Kristen Hannah did, that she focuses on, like, the women, the nurses that went. It was a very good book.
Oh,
it tells the story exactly how you say it. Like, they came back and they were, like, the enemy, really. So,
I've got a brother-in-law that was over there and had quite an experience, you know. I mean, if you were in the service, you never knew what. I mean, I had some friends in the Air Force that actually, they had, if you can even really say it out loud, mm-hmm. but, you know, it was a good experience. I mean, they weren't being shot at.
Mm-hmm.
And, but my brother-in-law was. And a story I repeat that he told me, he was running buddies with a friend he'd had for maybe 8 or 10 years
mm-hmm.
before either one of them had said out loud that they were over there. They were both over there at similar times in similar areas of conflict. But, I mean, that's how quiet they were about, I mean, they just wouldn't bring it up. They didn't,
sure.
you know. didn't want to, you know, cause some kind of upheaval or whatever. And it, to me, it was very telling that you could go that long.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sad, I think. Very sad.
For sure. Well, what did you say this really did to the business in Clarksville?
Well, it just made a really, really tough start.
Sure.
For opening up a store. After Madison, Clarksville, Madison, I think it was Hundred Oaks.
Ah, yes, I remember.
Hundred Oaks. You know, we were promised an interstate ramp off Citgo. Never did get it.
Right.
But, you know, that was a great store. And three stories. And we had furniture and stuff. After we closed downtown in 85, we moved all the buying offices, executive office, you know, accounts receivable, computer, you know, all those overhead type, you know, support areas were on the third floor. And then we had a little bit of sales in the middle. Brass and glass was most of that.
Brass and glass, I like that. So was that the last store to, whenever the store went out of business or sold out to Peebles, what was the last location that existed?
I'm not sure. We had, at one point, we had 10 stores.
Wow.
Until we closed downtown and then went back to 9. We were about to open, the mall was built, and we were about to take over the space in Oakwood Commons in Hermitage, and had purchased a lot of the decorations, had purchased a lot of the supplies, started purchasing for, you know, clothing and ready to wear and, you know, the stock for, you know, overall stock for the store. When the sale went through, it was prior to us opening the store, and it opened as a Peebles. But it was a new store design for us. It was based on Nordstrom's style of doing business, which was a shoe store that started, but they were very open. I mean, you could see from one end of the store to the other. They didn't have little walls, you know, doing little compartmental. And it was, and they had a lot of, like, antique furniture and old tables, and we had purchased all that, you know. We did a copy of that, and but it didn't get to open as Harvey's. We were close, and let's see. So Clarksville, Madison, Hundred Oaks, Murfreesboro was next in like 73, 74, I think. Then I think was Cookeville and Columbia.
Now, were these branch stores as like elaborate and include all the bells and whistles that the downtown one did with like the bar, the monkey? Clearly, the monkey bar was isolated to downtown, but like any other detail to them?
Hundred Oaks was our first enclosed mall store.
Okay.
And so Clarksville and Madison opened as strip centers. I take that back. Murfreesboro was also kind of a big L-shaped open strip center type situation. And I think we originally opened that one with Montgomery Ward, if I'm not mistaken. I believe that was the other anchor. A lot of, starting with Hundred Oaks, it was usually us on one end or in the middle, and Penny's, and then Woolco was the other anchor at Hundred Oaks. But Cookeville, we were an enclosed mall. We were on one end, Penny's on the other. Dyersburg, well, after that was Columbia. That was us. I can't remember I want to say we were actually in with Cast or Not, but it may have been Penny's and us and Walmart on one end. I think that was the Shady Brook Mall. So then we went to Dyersburg, and then Hopkinsville, then Madisonville, Kentucky's. Hopkinsville, Kentucky, Madisonville, Kentucky. Hopkinsville was the last one we opened prior to not quite opening But as far as I know, I believe Dyersburg, I went duck hunting maybe 10 years ago or less down in that area, at Real Foot Lake or in Obion County. And we stayed in Dyersburg, and Peebles was still open. And the store manager that we had hired to open that store and run that store became, I guess, as some kind of merchandiser or area manager with Peebles, and traveled. In other words, he moved up beyond his store manager position to some kind of regional manager or maybe merchandise manager.
Okay.
And, you know, the stores that we had operated for 20 or 30 years had gone, like Clarksville and Madison had gone, even Hundred Oaks, I think, had just gone into, you know, kind of like year-to-year type rent arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And those stores were closed down pretty quickly.
It's a shame.
So I don't know what happened at Hermitage. That would have been one of the leases, that longer leases that they would have, because we had operating clauses that, you know, meant if we signed up for 20 years, we were had to be running a store for that time. So that's kind of the branch story.
I gotcha. Well, I'm very curious then about the monkey bar. I have to ask, what stories do you have from the monkey bar that you can share?
Well, I remember the monkeys. And I guess it was a rather small cage, but they were rhesus monkeys, which I'm told are the most human-like, I guess, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they were a thing. They had some minor birds in the store, too. I can tell you a story about that, but I'll tell you that in a minute. The monkeys supposedly would get loose every now and then, and it was quite a ordeal, I think.
Can only imagine.
Swinging on the sprinkler pipes. And I was thinking about that on the way over. How did they catch those things? I mean, you know,
I was just about to ask.
I'm wondering who was in charge of running those things down. Were they able to lure them with, you know, bananas or something?
Right, yeah. You know,
I mean, I'm wondering. But they were quite the draw.
Oh, I bet.
And Max was really famous, you know, about running that. And, you know, he had very thick accent. And he had a 1 cent, you know, candy thing, you know, with licorice and hot balls and, you know, gum and I don't know what all. And they, you know, it came in jars. It was like and the kids, you know, he wouldn't allow any, you know, roughhousing or something. And if you were a certain size, he had an old belt that he'd strap you on to make sure you weren't going to fall off. And I remember one time he told me a story. I guess a lady was changing her kid's diaper, and that really offended him. And you know, there was a restaurant close by, but I mean, you know, take it to the restroom or whatever. Back then, you know, you didn't have the – hell, if they got tables that fold down now.
Yeah, it's different.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But
how long did the monkeys last?
They must have been around a long time.
Really?
Huh. I don't remember exactly, but I would say somewhere around my teenage years, they shut down the monkey bar, and that area more or less became like storage stock area for a bunch of different departments, and everybody had their own little cage, and they could, you know, put out a season stuff in there.
Oh, I see.
Or, you know, bring it out from there. So I want to say probably late 60s, maybe even early 70s.
Longer than I expected. Huh, okay.
I don't know when it started, but...
Just an idea that your grandfather had was like, this seems great, let's do
it. Well, it's fun to shop at Harvey's.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what that was about.
Yeah.
And, you know, theoretically, I guess if you didn't have really, really small children, but, you know, a certain age that you could kind of drop off
in
there, and then, then go shop. Mm-hmm. You could certainly give them something to do, you know, while you're eating lunch or, right. you know.
Now, were the monkeys next to the, did you say they were next to the food bar?
No. If you walked in to the right was the carousel. It was a small carousel, but, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. even a small one was, you know, I don't know what the diameter of that thing was. 30, 40 feet, I guess.
Yeah.
And then, so it kind of, it was the thing to see when you approach that area. And off next to that was the monkeys.
I see.
In the very back of that area.
Okay.
As you walked in, immediately to the left was where the monkey bar was. And it was a lunch counter type setup with stools, you know. And, you know, they would, you know, they had a soda jerk that would make milkshakes and
Ooh.
Malts and, you know,
nice.
Floats and
yeah.
Cokes and whatever. And kind of behind that, but out of sight, was where the grill was. And they could grill you up a hamburger or whatnot, French fries and a hot dog, that kind
yeah,
of thing.
That sounds good.
And along from the where the monkeys were, along the back wall, was all those rides.
So it's just an area for kids. I love it.
Yeah.
Smart idea.
All those little, you know, like there was a horse, of course, and, you know, a little car. And then, you know, the stagecoach was pretty impressive. And, oh, I forget what all we had, you know.
Yeah.
I had fun on those things without even putting up, you know, a nickel in them.
Yeah.
Just climbing all over them and just pretending like I was,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
And then that big elephant head.
Mm. I wonder where that ended up.
Don't know.
Mm.
Oh, and we had this old cowboy on a bench, you know.
I think I've seen pictures of that,
and,
maybe.
You know, he had his arms out so you could sit with the cowboy and get your
yeah.
picture made, that kind of thing. We had those mirrors, those circus mirrors that,
Ooh.
You know, that make you look 2 feet tall or 10 feet tall, depending on where you're standing. I've got one of those
like
stashed
that.
Away somewhere.
Nice.
I've got my brother's carousel horse and my father's and my own.
Very good.
So just kind of.
Yeah.
The kids may want it. My sister and I've, you know, we hadn't really figured out what to do with the mm-hmm. extra ones.
Hmm.
But,
that's pretty cool.
I cleaned hers up and mounted it. And
yeah.
So she's got it ready to display. And mine's on a stand, too.
Very cool.
At
you
my
don't
house.
Never know what to do with them. Archives. We'll be happy to take care of it. what was it like growing up in Nashville from a kid, like, up to just now? Have you lived in Nashville all your life?
Mm-hmm. My grandfather obviously moved here in 42.
Mm-hmm.
I think my father was in, like, fourth grade or something. He was probably 10, so that's about right. He went to Palmer Elementary School in West Nashville, and then that was K through 8. So he started there in fourth and went through 8, and then went to West High School.
Okay.
So as a freshman, and went through there, and then to Vanderbilt. I grew up in and around the same neighborhood he did, and used to walk to Palmer School. Went there from, I think I started there in first grade, and went through seventh grade, and that was about the time the busing was starting.
Yes.
And so I got shipped out to BGA, which.
Oh yeah, okay.
That was not a great.
No.
back in those days, it was unfun.
Ah, fair enough.
as a what you called an urchin.
Mm.
So, kind of unpleasant being, although I was held back. So, I had to repeat seventh grade. So, I had an extra year.
Mm-hmm.
I could stick up for myself pretty good, but it was.
Quite the experience.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So, anyway, he, when I was 14, I mean, you know, it was kids just playing out in the neighborhoods and, you know, without a care in the world, and, you know, if it started getting dark, you better get towards the house, you know, because it's going to be dinner time. And
mm-hmm.
everybody knew everybody in the neighborhood, and traffic was nothing. By the time I was 14, I got my motorcycle license, and thinking now, God, my parents were sure brave, but my father had a scooter when he was a kid, and I had many bikes and, you know, things like, and motorcycle was the next thing. Mm. But even if I was out riding around rush hour, you know, right down, right here, West End and Whitebridge Road, I might be third or fourth in line at the light. It was, you know, it's just not a big thing.
Yeah.
So.
And we get a lot of memories and whatnot shared on our social media page from people that grew up in Nashville. So it's, and how it's changed so much over the years. So I'm always interested to hear about people that knew it before it grew to the sort of larger city that it is now.
When I was young, I mean, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old for sure, catch a bus, go downtown.
Yeah.
And we get off at Union Station. And that was, I mean, they still did freight, but there was it's no longer passenger train. So there wasn't a whole lot, you know, there was switching and stuff going down in the gulch, but not so much like, you know, it was a place.
Yeah.
Where people traveled in and out of, and it was empty, and we had a secret way in in there, and we'd wander around, we'd see the big vault, the tower where the, you know, the Mercury was up on top.
Okay.
And we even started to go up, but it was rickety old.
Oof.
And I think those stairs would have collapsed under us even.
Oof.
So we backed out of there, but we occasionally sneak pennies under the railroad tracks, you know, under the,
yes.
See if we could, you know, mm-hmm. get one mashed. Got caught by the railroad detective.
Oh, no.
Yeah. He ran us off, but he got my dad's phone number. Mm-hmm. And so we got a tongue lashing for.
Oh, no.
But down on Dedrick Street where, you know, the performance mm-hmm. center and all that, was all pawn shops, and we'd go down there, and we had a, you know, we'd have to go through all those, you know, probably wear those guys to death. I'm sure they got tired of us showing up, but I mean, it was just free reign.
Yeah.
The arcade, all of that was, you know, yeah. It was kind of part of the playground on occasion, you know?
Yeah. Downtown was different during that time, and then changed quite a bit in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now it's kind of more of the touristy thing, whereas Broadway, probably during when you grew up, was what, furniture stores on Broadway at one point. I forget what else was down there, but it's
yeah,
not
Second Avenue.
Yeah,
Cohen's and
yeah,
yeah, it was lots of
yeah. Very good. Well, you mentioned earlier you were only 3 when your grandfather passed. Is that correct? Yeah. So you don't? Do you have any kind of memories you can share? Anything that I guess fits to his philanthropic personality that I've heard so much about, or anything personally?
Well, the bus benches were substantial.
Yes.
The ends of the bus benches were like concrete. I guess, you know, he didn't want people stealing them. But, you know, they have several planks connecting those two. And then several planks in the back.
Yeah.
And, you know, a gift to Harvey's, which, you know, was the same thing. I've got a big brass plaque you know, that said, you know, that the nativity scene was, you know, a gift to the people of Harvey's.
Right. Do you remember the nativity scene pretty well?
I do.
Nice.
She said 67 was the last year, I think. I was
yes.
10. So... You know, I'm sure I was paraded around there as a child. I remember the walk boards. It was kind of like lattice or, you know, because if we'd had a snow or a, you know, winter rain, then, you know,
oof, yeah,
all across the front of it, you know, because
yeah.
there was kind of a direction from one end to the other that people walked and parked and, you know, I remember the cold weather and just those walk boards for some reason.
Yeah.
I guess keeping you out of the mud. Sometimes it would squish up.
Ooh, that's smart thinking on his part. Or, yeah, realizing it.
Kind of the size and, you know, bigger than life type figures.
Yeah.
So.
They're pretty big.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So do you think if Harvey's was around today, it would be more successful or be able to survive? You know, department, they don't make department stores quite like that anymore.
Retail is, it's a fickle child. And, you know, it's pretty amazing, really, how poor the margins were. But when you were big and, you know, I guess there was enough, you know, changing hands. But, I mean, you know, 1-2% after taxes is, you know, I mean, you're operating a company that's given employment to a lot of people and servicing, you know, providing goods. And
yeah,
but it is so tough, and the hours are, golly.
Yeah, for sure. It seems like it survived at a time in Nashville history specifically that, like, it was perfect for that, the experience of going downtown and shopping, like, it was an all-day thing. So it was successful then because of a sort of the time frame, maybe, is what I would imagine. So I don't know.
Yeah, you know, it was, I mean, as different places, municipalities, whatever, kind of grew.
Yeah.
You know, that's the hub of everything going on. Usually there'd be the courthouse and state house, the, you know, government, whatever, and then the stores. And usually the more stores that you have kind of conveniently located. And so, you know, turn of the century, you know, 19th century, 20th century, I mean, that's where you went.
Sure.
And even here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the last of it was when I was young, but people, you know, I mean, you got dressed up and rode the bus downtown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was easy. But I guess as, you know, automobiles got to be kind of, every family at least had one.
Right.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And, you know, parking's mm-hmm. always been a thing.
Fact. Yep. So, definitely.
You know.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe somebody will ever bring it back. That would be pretty cool. like the Centennial Park nativity scene. I would love to see that come back specifically, but
yeah.
At its time. Before, I guess, we wrap things up, because I could ask a million more questions. This has been great. I just wanted to ask one more, I guess. Is there any other memories that you want our listeners to know from Harvey's, from growing up in Nashville, from your grandfather?
Well, you know, it's getting to be a time now, you know, 88. So we're coming up on 40 years.
Oh, right.
Since we closed the store. And so I can almost always identify old Nashvillians.
Yeah.
With, you know, if they have a memory. I don't bring it up. You know, there's not a reason to really bring it up. I used to avoid bringing it up because I didn't want somebody to just automatically have, you know, kind of an opinion of who
sure.
I was or what I was like. They could
sure.
get to know me, and then if there was an opportunity for that to come out. But people that know me or know about Harvey's, it kind of time stamps them for how long they've been here. And I love hearing the stories of, I mean, somebody's relative worked there. Almost everybody's relative worked there, it seems like.
You
know,
Opryland,
it was just so many, and they loved it so much, and they thought it was such a great place to work. And I used to have trouble understanding that because it was the only place that I was really aware of. You know, I took some other jobs, you know, when I was a kid, working at a gas station or whatever, fixing lawnmowers or pumping gas or whatever. But, you know, as far as kind of having a long-term relationship with an employer, it was the only one I knew. And, you know, I was part of the family. So yeah. I was treated a certain way anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. Obviously, who's going to give the boss's son a hard time? But they were always just nice, and the whole environment was so pleasant. And I would hear, you know, little stories about their Miss Anderson, who's used to be the county clerk for driver's license or for vehicle licensing. When she got engaged to be married, she bought a necklace that she was going to wear at the wedding. And, you know, that was a long time ago. And she was so excited to show me that.
She bought it at Harvey's?
She bought it at Harvey's downtown and took to wear. And anybody that knows very much about Franklin, Walton's Jewelry, you know, was around. And Melba Walton, who was my friend's mother, had tried to buy that necklace. You know, it was an antique, you know, an estate jewelry store. And they thought enough of it that she said, well, she wasn't going to let that go. It's kind of funny. But, I mean, just those stories is so warm. So I like hearing them because, you know, I'll hear something that I didn't know.
Sure.
I mean, there was so much going on. And, you know, through civil rights, Greenfield Pitts was one of the guys that sat down with, you know, the protesters and worked out an agreement because, you know, they had all the boycotts and stuff.
Right.
And we had a lunch counter. So, you know, the sit-ins and all that, and did as much as anybody.
Right.
And a lot of people don't know that. Some people took credit that really, really weren't that involved, but Greenfield Pitts was, he needs to be remembered for helping smooth out those situations.
Very good.
We were the first to give credit, you know, to
integrate.
Yeah, to the black folks and stuff.
That was definitely quite a time to live through, I can imagine. So, and then, to be in business, that's something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the people from Fisk and State were, Tennessee State, that were instrumental in those things. If, you know, they politically...
Right.
You know, they ended up in Washington and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that went all the way up to, like you say, all the way up to the government. Yeah, it's quite a history to it. Yeah, for sure. That could be a whole other podcast, which I gotta focus on that next. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, there's some stories.
Yeah,
Not like Montgomery or something, but, you know.
Wow. Very good. All right. Well, I think that just about wraps up. I think we've got quite a bit here. I could keep going. I have so many other questions, but just to wrap things up, though. But thank you for being on with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Right,
thank you so much for bringing this up. It's kind of, you know, I've often wondered, you know, what happens when you're gone? But now people can actually, you know, the old podcast that with a bunch of the old World War II veterans.
Right, yeah.
You know.
Those memories.
A lot of people I knew growing up, you know, they were there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was so young, you know, I didn't really grasp the enormity of that.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of get a taste of it. Vietnam was a whole different era that I did, you know, kind of, I think the first one Vietnam soldier killed in Vietnam was the year I was born in 57. So, you know. And I graduated high school in 75, which, you know, April was when Saigon fell. So, but to be able to listen to those stories of what those guys in World War II, I can't imagine how the kids growing up now would really understand what was on the line.
You know? Total different time. Yeah. Yeah.
So...
Very good. Well, thank you so much, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you.